This morning in the book of John, the 8th chapter. Now, some are persuaded that those first 11 verses in John, the 8th chapter, that they're not inspired of God, and they've just been kind of squeezed into those scriptures, but I vehemently disagree with that. I think that this amazing story in John, the 8th chapter, it's packed with vital truths that confirm that Jesus is the Christ, backing up that expression that the Sanhedrin officers made into the Sanhedrin that were required by them to arrest Jesus, but they didn't bring him back. And their response in the 7th chapter in verse 46 is, "No man ever spoke like this man." I suggest to you John chapter 8 clearly reveals that no man ever spoke like this man. I have an affection for this particular story. I bring it up a lot. And what I did this morning, I was just kind of looking through it, and I noticed a passage there in verse 5. And I want to focus on verse 5 this morning. In verse 4, they said to him, "Teacher, this woman was caught in adultery in the very act. And now Moses in the law commanded us that such should be stoned. But what do you say?" I really like that expression. What do you say? A lot of people are not listening to Jesus in our generation. Many of them had to listen to Jesus in the first century. Sadly, they didn't, and they didn't receive the benefits and the blessings that comes from God as a result. Many in our generation are not doing the same thing. We need to be hearing what Jesus is saying to us. What do you say? Now, this woman they brought was in the act of adultery, or they say she was caught in the act of adultery, a grievous sin, no doubt, one that the Old Testament has spoken about a great deal, as the New Testament also speaks about, a sin of infidelity and adultery, of unfaithfulness unto someone's spouse is going on. She was caught in that very act, at least that is the claim. And they looked to Moses and said, "Moses said this about this particular sinful activity. What do you say?" So I thought it would be interesting for us to consider exactly what is being said. When you set the stage, notice there in verse 53 at the end of chapter 7, everyone went to his own house, but Jesus went to the Mount of Olives. Now early in the morning he came again into the temple, and all the people came to him, and he sat down and taught them. Then the scribes and Pharisees brought to him a woman caught in adultery. And when they had set her in the midst, they said, "Teacher, this woman was caught in adultery in the very act." Where is Jesus? Early in the morning, he's exactly where you would expect a spiritual leader to be. He's there in the temple. In the temple in the city of Jerusalem. People came to Jesus in the temple. Jesus is teaching the people in the temple, no doubt, spiritual, wonderful principles. And in the midst of this, these evil, wicked religious leaders of Judaism drag this poor woman. And that's kind of the way that particular Greek language is set up. They basically drug her in before Jesus and set her down as a prop and basically said, "What do you say about this woman? What should we do?" I suggest to you just how evil that reflects upon these people. They are so wicked and they are so evil. If my understanding of history is correct, and I'm not sure about this because this is what the historians are telling us, but by the time the first century came, especially with the Roman Empire and the power that they had, that basically Jewish capital punishment was non-existent. That the Romans kind of frowned upon that the religious leaders very often, if capital punishment was to be enacted, that they would end up taking them before the Roman courts and things. And there in Matthew or in Leviticus and Deuteronomy, clear passages that talk about the execution of someone caught in sins like this, the execution of those that would be caught in adultery. By the time the first century came, if my understanding is correct, many of the modern Jews didn't look at that passage literally. They didn't consider those things to literally be done. That they would end up punishing, but it wouldn't entail capital punishment. Now, I don't know if that's accurate or not, but I get the feeling it was. And so they come with this woman as a prop, plop her down before Jesus in a very hostile direction, the way that the Greek designs, and basically said, "Moses said this needs to be done, but what do you say?" They think they had him. They think they had Jesus exactly where they wanted Jesus. If Jesus says, go ahead and do what Moses has to say, a lot of the Jews would have taken offense to that if the case was that they no longer were looking at this literally. A lot of Jews would say, where is all this mercy that he's been talking about? I thought he was talking about himself as being kind of a prince of peace and the need to blessed are the peacemakers, for great is their reward in the kingdom of heaven, that kind of thing. And they would be able to excoriate him. But if he said, no, I don't think we ought to do what Moses said, they could accuse him of being a sinner. You're not going to follow Moses. How dare you consider yourself to be a teacher of people if you reject what Moses has had to say? They thought they had him in the perfect trap. Well, did they have him in the perfect trap? Not when you hear Jesus. You never have Jesus in a perfect trap when he speaks. And that's exactly what we have here. They said in verse 5, but what do you say? Now, there in verse 6, a lot of people focus on that. This they said, testing him, that they might have something in which to accuse him. That was the purpose for this. But Jesus stooped down and wrote on the ground with his finger as though he did not hear. And a lot of times people are focusing on what he was doodling on the ground, and that seems to be the most insignificant part of the entire text. And I suggest to you that it is. We have no idea. He probably was just doodling around. And he was doing this as though he did not hear. It shows you just how well he knew these people. Jesus in John chapter 2 teaches us, or John tells us, that Jesus, he did not give these things to men because he knew what was inside of them. And he really knew what was inside of the leaders of Judaism. He was not going to give them great and wonderful truths so that they would abuse. And so there in verse 7, they continued asking him. They kept on, but what do you say? What do you say? What do you say? They just kept on pouring the pressure, thinking they had him. He wasn't responding. He's doodling as though he's not hearing. Now, you think about that for a moment. That kind of sounds like somebody that would be in a congressional hearing. They think they've got that politician right where they want him, and they hear them hemming and hawing and stuff like that. And in the case of a politician, they usually do have him. So they're just pouring the pressure on Jesus, but they don't have him. They just simply thought that they did. And the Son of God brought forth that one sentence. That one sentence. Imagine trying to handle such a difficult debate point with one sentence. It had to be some sentence, didn't it? It really was. Amazing sentence. Amazing sentence. It backed up John chapter 7, verse 46. That no man ever spoke like this man. Who would have ever thought of that particular line of reasoning? I guarantee you I wouldn't have. I would have felt the crucible, the controversy, and being squeezed between the vice grips, and probably would have uttered something pretty dumb. But not Jesus. He uttered the absolute perfect response to this particular issue, taking in all the variables that I was talking about. There's the woman that supposedly, and I think correctly, was caught in the act of adultery. And then there are the individuals that are doing this only to test him in order to try to destroy him. How would he handle the situation? Well, Jesus said unto them, he who is without sin among you, let him throw a stone at her first. And he says again, he stooped down and wrote on the ground after that happened. They continued asking him. He raised himself up and he said that line. He obliterated their plan with one sentence. It was over. The debate was over. Imagine that. Imagine going to a debate. It's been advertised. There's a great debate that's happening at the Westmobile Church of Christ. And there's the religious leaders here and the religious leaders there. And he gets up and he brings forth this great scenario. And with one sentence, the debate is over. That's exactly what this is. In one sentence, the debate is now over. Because these individuals, they actually heard what Jesus was saying. They heard the sentence that he made. And apparently, for just a moment in time, there was some honest investigation of those that were testing the Son of God. And beginning with the wisest to the youngest, the wisest to the non-wisest, so to speak, the oldest to the youth when it comes to maturity, recognizing the point, I'm in sin. I've sinned. I do have sin. I have committed sins against God. And with that point, I really can't throw a stone at her if that's the criteria that Jesus lays down. That's not the criteria they were expecting. They were expecting either let her go, or they were expecting keep what Moses had to say. Jesus threw them the most grandiose curveball imaginable, and they all struck out. The wisest ones from the beginning began to leave until eventually there was none there. Let's talk about the sin here for just a moment. The sin that they recognized. Here's the woman they caught an adultery, a grievous sin. Now, I know we don't really want to put various categories on sins, major sins, minor sins. That seems to be a Roman concept, and I think that it is a Roman concept. But adultery is a big deal, isn't it? It really is a big deal, and it has a lot of bad consequences that come with it. But what were they doing? They were tempting the Lord thy God. It kind of reminds me a little bit of the devil when Jesus was there in the wilderness and had been fasting for 40 days. And Jesus said, "Do not tempt the Lord thy God." Well, that's exactly what these individuals were doing. They were tempting the Lord God. Israel was really good at that. Israel, throughout their wilderness wanderings, throughout the Old Testament, how many times did they gripe and they complained and they moaned against God's leaders and against God Himself? Many times God would tell Moses or other leaders, "It's not you that they're going after, it's me they're coming after." Tempting the Lord thy God to wrath and anger, fury, destruction. They were tempting Jesus Christ. And this whole story reminds me of about the lesson that we studied together last week. Doesn't it remind you of that a little bit? In Matthew chapter 7, remember when Jesus had given that instruction unto the nation of Judaism, said, "Judge not that you be not judged, for with what judgment you judge, you'll be judged, and with what measure you use, to be measured back to you." Their measure was out of kilter. Would you like this measurement exacted unto you, leaders of Judaism, Pharisees, Sadducees, those of you that have brought this woman to me, and you're tempting me? You're tempting the Lord thy God? Why do you look at the speck in your brother's eyes but don't consider the plank in your own eye? I'm sure they didn't see it that way. I'm sure they saw the adultery as a huge, not just a monumental plank, but more like an ark. I think they thought it was the whole boat that was in this woman's eye. The problem is that the boats were in their eyes. And they didn't even see it. And that's what the Son of God was communicating. How can you say this? Let me remove the speck from your eye and look at planks in your own eye. It just doesn't make any sense. Don't you see yourselves? Can't you see the sin that you're involved with? It wasn't this woman caught in the act of adultery that was shouting, crucify him on that day. It was these Jewish leaders that were twisting the arm of Pilate, demanding that Jesus be hung upon a cross. Which sin is worse? They had planks all over their own eyes. Hypocrites. No wonder Jesus called them hypocrite. First remove the plank from your own eye, you'll be able to clearly see to remove the speck from your brother's eye. How important it was that we could always consider that passage. And very often those that appear or think themselves to be spiritual and religious, they're the ones that have the largest planks there are. You've got to be really careful that that not be us. What do you say in one sentence? Argument, debate, discussion, over. He stoops down on the ground writing like he doesn't listen to him, rises up, says one sentence, falls right back to the ground as though he's not going to listen to anything more they said. It was what we call in our generation a drop the mic moment, wasn't it? Moment is over, mic is dropped. And so we know what happens, right? As we keep reading there in John the 8th chapter, I thought I had my bookmark there. John the 8th chapter, and there in verse 8, he again stooped down and wrote on the ground, and those who heard it, being convicted by their own conscience, went out one by one, beginning with the oldest even to the last, and Jesus was left alone, and the woman standing in the midst. So there is the result of that one sentence, Jesus and woman is alone. And there in verse 10, when Jesus had raised himself up and saw no one but the woman, he knew exactly how this scenario was going to play out. He stooped down to the ground, rose up, declared the sentence, stooped back down to the ground, and they walked away one by one. He knows they're leaving. He knows who's leaving. He knows why they're leaving. And so when they all leave, he raised himself up again and saw no one but the woman. The woman didn't leave, by the way. He said to her, "Woman, where are those accusers of yours? Has no one condemned you?" There's, what did Jesus say in this scenario? It's just the woman and him alone. "Woman, where are those accusers of yours? Has no one condemned you?" I want you to think about this for a moment. People say, did he give them the right answer? Well, if you go back to Deuteronomy chapter 17, if we're thinking about what Moses was saying, in Deuteronomy chapter 17, in verses 5 through 7, that's why Jesus is the master communicator. Here in verse 5 it said, "Then you shall bring out to your gates that man or woman who has committed that wicked thing, and shall stone to death that man or woman with stones. Whoever is deserving of death shall be put to death on the testimony of two or three witnesses. He shall not be put to death on the testimony of one witness. The hands of the witnesses shall be the first against him to put him to death, and afterward the hands of all the people. So you shall put away the evil from among you." I know some might consider this a technicality, but that's the way law very often works. There was no witnesses. There were no witnesses there to stone the woman to death. Even if she was caught in the act, there was no accusers there to accomplish what the law of Moses had taught. And you almost wonder, when Jesus brought forth that particular sentence, he knew exactly that all the witnesses would walk away. And so there would be no one there that would be able to stone her. And therefore the woman wouldn't die as a result of the act that she committed. Oh, the wisdom of God. You can't be executed without the trial, without the guilty verdict, and without the witnesses personally involved in that. But now here's the woman alone, standing toe-to-toe with the real judge of humanity. I don't know what her reaction was. I sometimes would like to see, how would Hollywood picture this? What would they think? Because, you know, that's what Hollywood does. They very often try to get into the minds of the actors and speculate what might be going on within their minds. I would love to know what was going on within her mind. I don't know really what was going on in her mind. Relief? Confusion? Fear? I don't know what was going on in her mind. My guess is she realized at that moment she wasn't going to die. At that very second she wasn't going to die, when everybody was walking away and not throwing stones at her. But now she's alone with the great teacher. The great teacher that's able to look through the heart and the soul of men to know what's going on within them. The great teacher that knows really whether or not she was committing adultery. Because he knows everything. He's God. I have no idea if she thought of him in that fashion. I don't know if she thought of him as the prophet. Now, she did say a little bit later on in this expression in verse 11, she said, "No one, Lord." I don't think that means that she thought of him like Martha did, that he's the Christ, the Son, living God. I think it was just probably the title of respect that very often was given from inferiors to superiors. The idea of yes, sir, no, sir, that kind of concept. It could be that. It might be different. That word just simply doesn't give us the idea one way or another. But there she stood all by herself with Jesus Christ. And Jesus had asked her two questions. Where are those accusers of yours? They're rhetorical questions. They're gone. Has no one here to condemn you? There's no one here. So they answer themselves. And so we have a third phrase from Jesus. Where are those accusers? Are there none here to accuse you? She said, "No one, Lord," in verse 11. And Jesus said to her, "Neither do I condemn you. Go and sin no more." Neither do I condemn you. Did Jesus really do the right thing? Let's say she was guilty of adultery. She very well was. I think just by the way he brings forth this sentence indicates that she's guilty of adultery, of what she's been accused of. Did he do the right thing? Well, yes, he did the right thing because of the mission and the nature of what Jesus was there for. There was a particular reason why the Son of God had taken on a robe of flesh and come to this earth. And he tells us that over and over again throughout the gospel story. in John chapter 3, that very famous section of Scripture in verse 16. God so loved the world that He gave His only begotten Son. He's talking about Himself. That whoever believes in Him should not perish but have everlasting life, verse 17. For God did not send His Son into the world to condemn the world, but that the world through Him might be saved. He didn't send Jesus into the world to say, hey, sinner, zap, lightning bolt, gone, toast. That's not what Jesus came to the earth for. He didn't come around to start judging everybody. He didn't need to do that because all of us have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. It's just a matter of degree. It's a matter of degree. How many do you have? 10,000, 100,000, 500,000? I'm kind of looking at my life. How many sins have you committed against God? He didn't have to come and start enumerating the sins of man. He would have been there all day and all night, and no one would have been able to stand before Him as one that was right with God, because all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. He didn't come to judge and execute them. He came to save them. And that's why you find in the New Testament why Jesus was eating with the tax collectors and the sinners. It's exactly what the religious leaders of Judaism should have been doing. They should have been going out to those that were committing terrible atrocities against God and His law and trying to help them come out of those atrocities. Should have been more compassionate, more concerned about them, weighing the idea of mercy and truth and trying to help people to do what's right so they can go to heaven when they die. That's not what the leaders of Judaism were doing to the nation of Israel. But Jesus came for that purpose. He came to seek and to save those that are lost. Now, if there's ever somebody that should have been that way, it would have been the leaders of Judaism. If you think about those that would have been the most painful thorns in the side of Jesus, it had to be the religious leaders of Judaism. When you look at Matthew 23, for example, that famous woe section, you just list woe after woe. These people are horrible hypocrites with the way in which they approach God and religion. And you look, for example, in verse 34 of Matthew 23, he says, I send you prophets, wise men, scribes. Some of them you kill and crucify. Some of them you scourge in your synagogues. You persecute from city to city. Actually, when you put that aside, the idea of a woman having an adulterous fling with another man, which one do you think has far worse ramifications for the nation as a whole? Jesus knew. He said that on you may come the righteous blood shed on all the earth, from the blood of righteous Abel to the blood of Zechariah. What does that mean? I always look at it. It's from the A to Z. It's all the prophets. From Abel to Zechariah, son of Berechiah, who you murdered between the temple. Assuredly, I say to you on these things, all these things will come on this generation. Assuredly, I say, there is wrath coming on this generation. And you look in verse 37, you get the feeling that maybe the scene has changed a hair, but it's still about what Jesus is talking about. Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the one who kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to her. How often I wanted to gather your children together as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, but you're not willing. I think Jesus said this with a bit of anger within His heart. Well, let me be careful about that. In His voice. Bit of anger. I wanted to save you, but you don't want it. I wanted to heal you. You don't want it. I wanted to help you become what you need to be. You're not going to get it. Your house has left you desolate. For I say to you, you shall see me no more till you say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Oh, the planks. The Son of God saw the entire ark, the whole boat in their eyes. And yet He didn't destroy them at that moment, did He? The reason He didn't destroy them at that moment, because that wasn't His mission. His mission was to seek and save maybe even them. He was going to go to that cross. Maybe some of them would recognize after He died, was buried, and rose from the grave that they too needed saving. And we just studied the book of Acts and we found out some of those people did do that. Some of those people did wake up. And they were saved instead of perishing. And so what do we have? We have basically a concluding remark at the end of this. And this is where I stop. What do you say? I could just keep going through John chapter 8. But I just decide I'll stop here because it just seems like it's the conclusion to the matter. It's the way that I kind of see it. Maybe it's not, but it seems like it is. Jesus spoke to them again, saying, "I am the light of the world. He who follows me shall not walk in darkness, but have the light of life. I did not come to judge. I've come to save. I've come to save people. I've come to illuminate the way. I've come to help this poor woman that's got this speck in her eye. And I want to remove the speck from her eye. And so that's why I told her, go and sin no more." Have the mentality of repentance. Really confirm that you're sorry for what you did against God and that you're going to leave this place with a determination. I'm not going to do that again. That's what makes me think that she actually did commit the sin. Just that reaction Jesus gave. And so basically it's finished up with, I'll illuminate your way. Whether you happen to be someone that's caught in the act of adultery, which we tend to think is a horrendous, terrible sin, and it is. Whether you're caught in the idea of tempting and testing God when we ought not be tempting and testing the Lord our God like the devil did there when he was in the wilderness fasting for 40 days. Or acting like someone that was trying to usurp the authority and gain all the glory for themselves rather than give the authority to the Messiah who truly deserves it all. Jesus said, I am the light of the world. Jesus is the one that illuminates it. He is the one that gives life unto those who are worthy of death. He is the one that brings light to our paths, and He's the one that brings us life. Not just the idea of life here on earth, but life beyond this life. In heaven with God forever. And so as it was for her, as it would have been for the disciples that were following, as it would have been for those that walked away from Him, from the wisest to the youngest, the Son of God has light and life. I just happened to be combing the internet. I found this little chart. I thought, that's really good. I just have to show it to you. Someone brought forth the simple plan of God's salvation. And he began with the idea of people walking in darkness. And that's exactly what we're doing if we have sin on our soul. We're in darkness. We're in the darkness of sin. Sin has us captivated. And we need to hear about Jesus and grace that He offers through the gospel. If we'll believe that Jesus is the Christ with all of our hearts, and determined to do something like that woman when he said, go and sin no more. It's the idea of turning to God and turning away from a sinful walk of life. Be willing to confess our belief and our faith in Jesus Christ. And then be baptized into His death, buried with Jesus Christ in baptism, so we can be raised to walk anew, a new life, to find abundant life, to find what Jesus had set out for all of us to find. That He came and died and did His part on the cross, and He's made it possible for us to be forgiven of our sins and to be able to walk in His light and be able to go all the way to the very throne of God in heaven when this life is over. He's made that possible. It is the first steps of an illuminated life. A lot of people claim to be brilliant. They claim to be enlightened in life. Those who are enlightened are those who choose the path of Jesus Christ and make it to heaven. That's the enlightened group. We want you to be a part of that. We want you to understand that regardless of what kind of enemy you've been towards God, whatever sin you've committed, how grievous it may be, He can forgive adultery. He can forgive those that would tempt and blaspheme His name. He can forgive you if He can forgive that. Whatever sins you've been involved with, you can come to Jesus. He will light your world. Listen to what He says. Do what He asks. There's someone in the audience that would like to do that very thing. Please come to the front while Chris leads us together in this song.